from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I thought I would bring on my next guest. You all know Clint Van Zandt is a retired FBI agent, author, safety expert, analyst, you name it. He does a lot of work on MSNBC and NBC to talk about a couple of cases. One is Morgan Harrington, sadly, or not so sadly, because she was actually recovered in some cases like this. We don't recover the missing. But I want to talk first of all about an article that Clint wrote on Newsvine.com, and again, a lot of Clint's articles are there at Newsvine.com, about a potential terrorist attack that was prevented, and about an individual by the name of Lloyd Woodson, and we didn't hear about this much in the media. Hi, Clint.
Hi, Dana. Good evening.
Let's start with Woodson. Big story, and besides what I saw you writing, and maybe a little bit more, there wasn't a lot about this. This was a tragedy that was averted by some good work.
Well, I think it was. I think it was just very good. It was a good combination of work between an alert citizen doing what he or she should do, which is pick up the phone when you see something that bothers you and call 911, and the just basic street cop response who came. And as you know, this is a situation that took place in New Jersey. And it was about 4 a.m. in a strip mall in New Jersey that a clerk saw this guy was kind of wandering around and loitering near the store. And the clerk just, you know, saw the guy wearing a kind of a military green type jacket. And he just didn't look like he belonged there. So she, the clerk did what you had to do, called 911. And the first responding officer, you know, thank God, police officers sometimes, Dana, as you know, develop kind of like that Spider-Man-like sixth sense when something just doesn't look right, when the guy's eyes, his hands, the clothes he's wearing. Well, with this officer saw the jacket the guy was wearing. It was kind of a bulge under it. Police officer takes him aside and wants to talk to him. The subject said, well, I'm here to get some food, and then he takes off running. And now we've got this foot chase, and eventually a couple other responding officers came, and they found this guy hiding under some bushes, and he fought with him. They had to pepper spray him. And when they finally got him down and got him cuffed, the bulge under his coat turned out to be this guy is wearing not only a bulletproof vest, but, Dana, he's got that extra steel plate that most soldiers in combat wear that'll stop, you know, a heavy round like an AK-47 round or something coming through. But under his jacket, he's also carrying a Bushmaster 223 assault rifle, probably about the same make and model that the DC sniper used back in 2003 to kill 10 people. And so, you know, they look at the rifle, and it's been modified to fire 50 caliber ammunition. And as you and I know, that'll punch through, you know, a car, a house, or about 15 people standing back to back.
Yep.
And he's got three loaded magazines on him. So they trace this guy back to a local hotel room. They go back. They find another .308 rifle. Once again, the serial number is filed off. They find a 37-millimeter grenade launcher. They find another bulletproof vest. They find a night scope for a rifle, a police scanner, and hundreds of 50-caliber and .308 rounds, other military-type equipment that's around there, as well as a Middle Eastern red and white a traditional headdress that, you know, sometimes is worn in Somalia, but it's also worn in other places in Middle East. Now, this guy turns out to be, he is a former Navy deserter who lived in Virginia, but what he was doing in New Jersey and where he got all these weapons and what he was planning on doing is still unknown. You know, my former organization, the FBI, came in and they said so far they couldn't find any links to terrorism, but, you know, if we look back to the Oklahoma City bombing, Timothy McVeigh didn't necessarily have any links to terrorism, but I think there was no doubt he was a domestic terrorist, and this guy could well have been a terrorist to be that was averted, again, by a good citizen and some good work by street cops.
Yeah, I love that term, spider sense, because, you know, it is so true, and if the public uses their spider sense as much as, you know, most street cops use theirs, maybe we can prevent more possible terrorist attacks like this. This guy certainly was armed enough for one. Let's talk a little bit more about Woodson. You know, a Navy deserter, whether or not he's a fundamentalist, it's those types that are still roaming around out there that bring the potential of that New York City trial of the other terrorists. It just scares the hell out of me, Clint.
Well, it does. And, you know, you can either be, as you suggest, you could be a radical Islamic fundamentalist like the U.S. Army major who staged the attack at Fort Hood did, or you could be like this, the individual who just recently died in jail who did the attack on the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. I mean, he was a lone wolf, single interest, senior citizen terrorist. But when he started wheeling that rifle around, he was as deadly as anybody else could be. And I think that's our challenge right now is, you know, we're trying to be so politically correct and not necessarily call anybody a Islamic or a radical Islamic terrorist. Well, there's a lot of other reasons why people commit terroristic acts other than simply a religion or faith they're connected to. It could just be a personal belief system they have. But, you know, these are the things that people have to be looking for. They have to look, what doesn't belong? What looks out of place? And then you don't have to figure it out yourself. That's why we have, you know, in the United States, you know, a little short of a million police officers and deputies and troopers. You pick up the phone and you call them, or you call the Mounties, or you call whatever force you have nearby to come, and you just share what you saw with that officer, and you let he or she figure out, is it a bad guy, is it a crazy guy, or is it a gun collector who just didn't want to leave his guns in the hotel room?
Absolutely. Clint Van Zandt is here, and we're talking about a potential a terrorist attack, if you want to use that term. Nevertheless, some good police work and good civilian work that took a lunatic off the street. However, this lunatic is only in on $75,000 bail. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, $75,000 bail. Now, jeez. You know, what they're going to, you know, charge him with eventually is going to be interesting. But with this wealth of weapons, you know, one wonders where he would get all these guns. And why would you be wearing, number one, an armored vest, and number two, with that extra plate in front of it? I mean, he's either saw, you know, too many episodes of some type of Iraqi war movie or something like that, or this was a man with a mission, and he just didn't quite get that gun up when that first officer got to him, and thank God for that. Had that guy started cranking off 50 caliber rounds, I mean, that bullet could still be flying.
Absolutely. Have you heard, Clint? Is he talking at all?
No. And that's the thing, that so far he has refused to talk to law enforcement, and what he has said, you know, they question what his reasons are and what he's doing in New Jersey, coming from Virginia. So there's a lot up in the air, and you're right on, it's been kind of a lid of silence just dropped on that case.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've had the same type of lid that was dropped on the underwear bomber case. And, you know, I my former organization, the FBI, I think did a good job on that. They let people just go on and suggest that they only interviewed this guy for 50 minutes and then shut him down by offering him his rights. But at the same time, they flew his father and his mother and a number of his family members from overseas here, sat down with them, used the family against him, and now they've got this guy singing and talking and telling us everything he can about Al-Qaeda, who put him up to this. So, you know, sometimes everything in the media is not necessarily what's going on. I'm sure you and I were involved, you know, in investigations over the years. You'd hear the media take off on some tangent, and you'd think, where did they ever get something like that? Because you're right in the middle of the investigation, and you know better. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you got to admit, there's a little happiness in a part of law enforcement when they see the media kind of step in it themselves and say, hey, go ahead and say negative things, because eventually it's going to come out that we were right on top of this case.
Absolutely. You know, you said that very well. Let's talk about another article of yours, and something you and I have talked about on this program before, the missing Morgan Dana Harrington has been found.
Yes, she has, and that was really a sad thing. You know, when she disappeared, as you know, she was a Virginia Tech student who had attended a Metallica concert on October 17th on the University of Virginia campus. This is a strange story, Dana, that she had bought her ticket 6 months in advance. I mean, this was the golden ticket. I mean, she spent all day just picking out the clothes she was going to wear to that concert when she and three girlfriends and a guy all drove together from the Virginia Tech area to UVA. They go into the concert. They present their tickets. They go in. They sit down. You know, and as usual, there's warm-up bands playing. And she tells her friend she has to go to the restroom. Well, now, Dana, this is a big stadium. There are 18 separate women's restrooms inside of the concert venue. You don't have to go outside to go to a restroom. 18 separate ones. And her parents acknowledge she had been drinking. And she gets up. She tells her friends, I'm going to the restroom. Dana, you know, again, nobody's responsible but the person who murdered this young woman. But
yep.
You know, you look back over the years, and women always go to the restroom together,
that's
you know?
Right, yep.
And number one, it's a social thing. But, Dana, number two, it's a smart thing. Mm-hmm. Whenever you're out together, you know, you go back to the movie Top Gun, and Tom Cruise taught us in that movie, you never leave your wingman. And I think that should be the case with people when they're out, when you're in a different venue, when you're in an area that you could be vulnerable if you've been drinking and doing something else. When you go to the restroom, go two by two. And somehow she winds up outside of the concert area, tries to get back in. They tell her when she goes out, you're not going to get back in, lady. They don't let her back in. She huffs and puffs and raises a bunch of noise. She's seen two or three different times. One person says she's wobbling as she's walking. Another alleged witness says that she looks like she'd fallen down. She had blood on her chin. Yet another witness saw her walking with four young men that were all dressed in black, and they were seen in a RV parking area, the same area where her cell phone was recovered with the battery out, and her purse was missing or found there. Then she's seen about a half an hour later near a bridge outside of the area hitchhiking, and that's the last she's seen till last week when a farmer found her remains in a very remote field of his about 10 miles south from the concert. Well, the medical examiner has now ruled her death to be a homicide, so that takes away any idea that some people have had that, gee, could she have walked for 10 miles? In the way she was dressed, absolutely not. So we know cause of death now is homicide. And, of course, the big question not only, of course, is who did it, but what's the method of death? And as you know, law enforcement, they have to consider strangulation, blunt force trauma, a firearm, a knife. Could it have been a drug overdose or something else? And because of the advanced stage of decomposition, it's going to be interesting if, in fact, they're going to be able to determine the exact method of her death.
Clint Van Zandt's here, and if you have more information on the disappearance of Morgan Dana Harrington, you can go to the website, www.findmorgan.com, or call the 24-hour tip line at 434-352-3467. Let's talk about the witnesses in this case, Clint. And in any case, something that we do at the police academy all the time, you can have a suspect walk through a room of police officers trained in observance, and you'll get out of 24 police officers 22 different descriptions of the person who just walked through. Witness testimony is so important, but sometimes it isn't always the whole case. Your thoughts?
Or you said it. Eyewitness testimony is probably the worst possible evidence we could have, but it's better than nothing. You know, as an FBI agent in New York, I used to teach bank robbery seminars to bank tellers. We would have a large auditorium full of bank tellers, and we'd come in and we'd talk about some of the recent robberies and techniques, takeover robberies, no jobs, things like that. And one of the things we would do is that out in the hall, we would set off a large firecracker in a waste can, and then we would have two or three guys run into the room, you know, one with a fake sawed-off shotgun, one with a fake handgun, various clothing, one guy'd be black, one guy'd be white, and they'd yell a couple of things and then run out of the room again. And then we'd say, okay, ladies and gentlemen, look under your chairs. You will find a pencil and piece of paper under each chair. We want you to write a description of the people that you just saw. I mean, Dana, just like you said, it is all over the map. White, black, green, yellow, tall, short, no guns, guns, mask, no mask. So, you know, what that shows you is that the mind is not a camera. And even though we see something, that mind doesn't necessarily take a picture of what we saw. And then when you start to listen to other people suggest what they saw, and it's two or three days later perhaps, some people want to be very helpful. They want to share information. They want to know something that helps. And all of a sudden, something that had nothing to do with the case now becomes entangled in the middle of it, and law enforcement is left to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, absolutely. Clint Van Zandt is here. One thing that may be important, and I don't profess to say I'm privy to any of the aspect of this investigation or the inside aspects of this investigation, would be, though, DNA, Clint, and importance of DNA today. Gee, I wish we'd have had this 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, law enforcement has got two things going for it right now. Until last week, they had a missing persons case, and most people suspected she had met with foul play. But now we have two very good things for an investigation in a worst-case scenario like this. Number one, you have the victim's remains. And number two, you have one of three likely crime scenes. As you and your listeners know, in a case like this, you probably have three crime scenes. One is where the victim was initially taken, kidnapped, carried away, which could have been that RV parking lot where her cell phone and purse were left. Number two is the vehicle that the victim was likely transported in. Again, realize this is over 10 miles south from the University of Virginia, and the farmer who found the victim's remains said it's almost a mile and a half from any road to get to that location, and that in fact he can't drive there in a four-wheel drive, that he has to use a tractor to get where her body was found, although I think law enforcement was able to get to it. It probably depends on if the ground's frozen or damp or something like that. But as you suggest, the potential for linking physical evidence is going to be there. Her clothing is there. Should we get hairs, fibers, DNA, saliva, semen, whatever it's going to be, should the assailant have just thrown down a cigarette butt? Should he have been able to drive a car out there? And we have car tracks. There's a lot of different things that hopefully law enforcement will develop as they have done their search of that crime scene area, and hopefully they'll find something that will be able to link them to the offender. As you know, there's at least $150,000 reward. Yep. And even though rewards don't necessarily make these type cases, at this point, hopefully somebody's going to know something and that'll share it. They'll know they would have seen her, or they would have heard second or third hand, and they'll share it. Number one, because there's a killer or killers out there, and realize it could be multiple individuals. And number two, you know, there is $150,000. But the issue to me, Dana, is that who was able to transport that victim these 10 miles, and who knows their way around? I mean, this is not somebody from 100 or 200 miles away. This is not necessarily a Metallica groupie who was in town for the first night. To me, to know even how to get to that location where the victim's body was dropped, and then to take it out into the middle of a field where you'd have to probably park a vehicle and walk out there or carry the victim out there, that suggests, number one, somebody who knows their way around, and number two, somebody who's comfortable that they could do that without being seen.
Yeah, forensics, evidence, internet, you name it. It could be a random thing. It could have been somebody that knew that she was going there. This is a big investigation. Clint Van Zandt's here for about another 5 minutes, and I want to get your thoughts, Clint, and let's I want to tie this into a little bit to the news coverage. We talked about the potential terrorist attack that was thwarted, and I'm using that term, Dana Harrington, and the lack thereof, Morgan Harrington, the lack thereof of coverage, somewhat with the cable news channels. But we're hearing tonight, and some breaking news that Conrad Murray will be turning himself in tomorrow, and will be charged with involuntary manslaughter for Michael Jackson. And you and I both know the TV channels, the shows, and I'm sure you'll probably be asked to comment on it.
We'll be all over that one, and it's amazing. That you know, even though, you know, as you know, I work for NBC and MSNBC, the media still are, you know, in some cases just junkyard dogs. There are some cases that they're all over. You know, Dana, whenever we cover these stories of missing and dead children or young adults or otherwise, there's not a time that I don't get an email. Someone said, I saw you on the Today Show. I see you talking about that little girl that's missing in Florida. But what about my daughter? What about my son? He or she is missing, and I can't even get the local news to cover it. And there are shows on television that cover that story every night. I mean, it was, you know, for example, the Natalie in Aruba.
Holloway.
Yep. Well, Natalie Holloway case, you know, we cover that night after night, week after week. And I remember walking in with Greta Van Susteren to do television one night. I said, Greta, you know, we're just beating this case to death. And she said, you know what? She said, my ratings have almost doubled when we started doing that case. Well, that's not anything negative about Greta. That's just her and her network realizing what stories sell and what stories don't. But the Michael Jackson, that indictment, that'll sell, while other people who have missing and deceased loved ones will be lucky to get an also-ran on the second section of a newspaper.
Absolutely. Clint's website, one of them anyway, is www.livesecure.org. It's always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That's Clint Van Zandt, and I wanted to bring him on tonight to talk, and we're going to talk more about Morgan Harrington a little bit later on with Blank from blankoncrime.com. But I wanted to bring Clint on to talk about that. He writes excellent articles at Newsvine, and especially talk about that potential terrorist attack that was thwarted. You know, you have a grenade launcher and high-powered weapons and police scanners and lead-lined bulletproof vests and all this sort of stuff. Using the word terrorist, I think, is pretty safe. Whether there's a fundamentalist aspect to it or not, I don't know. But shame on the media for not covering that the way they should, or at least the aspect that we do here at Scared Monkeys Radio, where, you know, if you see something as a civilian or as a citizen, and your spider sense, like Clint says, starts to tingle a little bit, you should call it in. It's that important. If you're wrong, you're wrong. If you're right, you could save many, many lives. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to come back in a minute with WKRG reporter Jessica Taloney and get an update on the Becca McAvoy case. I want to tell you, you know, for the years that I've been doing this program and the work that we've done here at Scared Monkeys and Scared Monkeys Radio, you know, we try to help victims the best we can. And this case, talking about little Becca, talking about her family, covering the story many, many times on the show, to see them finally get some justice. So this case went to court because it had been delayed so many times. I know I've said in the past four times, but I think it was as many as six. The case finally went to court. There was a conviction, a sentence yet to come, February 25th, I believe, but I wanted to bring on, and I did record this interview about 45 minutes before the show started. One of the reporters from down in that area, Jessica Taloney from WKRG Television, who's covered that story right from day one, and Jessica Taloney will join me here in a minute on the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You know, I've done this show for many, many years now, and I try to stay as neutral as I can, but I tell you, covering this case and talking to the family as much as I have, I've come to, first of all, admire all of the family of Becca McAvoy, admire the reporting in the case, and really admire the system now that we have a conviction. And of course, I'm talking about Becca McAvoy and the sad case of the little girl who tragically died before she was able to testify against her alleged abuser, who Bob Engel, who has since been convicted of such. And one of the reporters that has been covering this case from day one is Jessica Taloney from WKRG, and she joins me on the telephone. Hi, Jessica.
Hi there.
Welcome back to the program. You know, and I'm sure you feel the same way. You cover lots of cases all the time, but this one I'm sure tugged at your heartstrings too.
Well, there's no way it couldn't. And the most important thing, I think, about this case, especially as it went to trial last week, is that this family finally did get their day in court. I think that was the concern all the way through it, whether, you know, whether the defendant ended up being guilty or not guilty. The family needed a sense of justice. They needed to be able to face him in court and have a jury hear their story, and that happened.
Good point. And for those of you that don't remember, there was a precedent case that was stated, Crawford versus Washington, which basically, and Jessica can correct me, which says that an accuser or an accused should be allowed to cross-examine the accuser. In this case, poor Becca had passed away. There were, I think, four delays in this case before it went to trial.
Oh, many more than four. It was at least six is what I counted up, six different trial dates that were set, and that doesn't count all the countless hearings in between, but at least six trial dates before it finally went to trial.
Now, I've interviewed many of the family members, spoken to them on the phone, both on the air and off the air, and I know how, I just can't imagine. You know, we all think that we have problems in our family, but when something like this hits you and hits you hard, it's got to be extremely difficult to deal with, and I'm always amazed at the strength that these families are able to bring forward. But let's talk about this a little bit, Jessica. Let's go back to the original allegation against Bob Engel.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the original allegation first surfaced, I believe it was December 2006. He was a police officer on the Chickasaw Police Force up here in Mobile County. And he was arrested based on what Rebecca had told her. First, it was her best friend, and then she told her sister, and then her sister took her to a local hospital here to be examined. And from there, that's where the case started. He was arrested, and about a year after his arrest, the investigation continued with Rebecca testifying before the grand jury, with, of course, her talking to different investigators, talking to the doctor, a nurse, a counselor. All of this happened in the year before she died.
If you're just joining us, WKRG reporter Jessica Taloney is here, and we're talking about the Becca McAvoy case. Now, Becca was killed in a car accident. Her father, Aiden, was also seriously injured. Take us back to that day when she was killed in the accident. Where was she on her way to?
Well, I'm not sure the circumstances of the accident. All I know is that it was completely unrelated to the case itself, short of the fact that she did die, and that caused constitutional questions. But it was January 2008 that she was killed, and if I remember correctly, she was with her biological father, who was also a police officer. He was injured in that wreck, and of course Rebecca was killed. But we were not aware at that time, if I recall, because of course it was 2 years ago, at that time we were not aware that it was Rebecca McAvoy in that case, and that she was the victim in this case with the Chickasaw police officer that we had reported on. It took a little while for two and two to come together, and in fact it was when the family called us in tears, just very concerned that the case was falling apart because of Rebecca's death. That's when we realized the connection there, and that's when the reporting really started.
Now, Engel's attorneys have fought this case and tried to get it dismissed based on what they say is his constitutional right to confront his accuser. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, they have. I mean, there was hearing after hearing and delay after delay. And in the end, the judge in this case basically sorted out what could be admitted into evidence, what testimony would be allowed, and what wouldn't. And I believe the way prosecutors explained it to me is that anything that was any testimony that would have come as a result of an evidence-gathering process wasn't going to be allowed. An example is the police officer that led this case, that led the investigation, was not allowed to testify about anything Rebecca told him. Somehow that violated that Supreme Court ruling.
Right.
So he only could testify about where the incident happened, but nothing really more than that. I mean, his time on the stand, which is unusual in this case, the investigator's time on the stand was probably no more than 2 minutes. The testimony that was allowed was what Rebecca told her best friend, what Rebecca told her sister, And what the doctor was able to see with his own eyes and in examining what he got from his examination, that's what was allowed. So it was a very short trial. I mean, given that it took 3 years to get to this point, the trial itself took about 2 days of testimony.
Yeah, and I hear that the jury was only out 9 hours, but we'll get to that in a little bit.
90 minutes.
Oh, 90 minutes. Wow, my notes here say 9 hours, but that's even more, you can see that they had their mind made up, that's for sure. Let's talk a little bit about the ADA, Ella Byrd, and how she did in this case.
Well, you know, she had a big challenge ahead of her, especially because of the constitutional questions. She came into this case late. I know you reported on your show about the prosecutor being pulled off the case. Steve Giardini was his name. He was the ADA that was handling it. He resigned from the district attorney's office under a cloud of suspicion of his own, unrelated to the case, but it threw another wrench into what had already been a slow process. So a new prosecutor came on board, and she's been handling it. I wouldn't want to guess on how long now. It's been several months. I think it was midsummer when she got on board. And, she had the challenge before her was figuring out what testimony or following the judge's guidelines on what testimony would be allowed and sticking to it and still being able to prove her case without some really key elements, you know, not the least of which being the investigator.
If you're just joining us, WKRG reporter Jessica Taloney is here, and we're talking about the conviction of Bob Engel in the Becca McAvoy case. If you could, Jessica, let's talk a little bit about Rebecca's sister, Nina Tucker, whose testimony I hear was very emotional.
Her testimony was without a doubt the most emotional testimony of the trial. Now, we couldn't sit in. Everybody was asked to leave when the best friend testified because she's young. I think she might be 13 now.
Right.
So we were all removed from the courtroom for her testimony, so I'm not sure what she said. But of the testimony that we heard, Nina's by far was the most emotional. I mean, she broke down on the stand several times, which I think most people that have been following it really anticipated because she's been emotional in every interview that we've done with her and every time we've seen her in the past. But she basically testified about how Rebecca came to her after Rebecca went to the best friend. Rebecca went to her sister and also told her about what happened. And the way she described that happening was she said that she was riding in a car with Rebecca. She was driving. Rebecca was with her. She's an older sister. She is, I believe, 25 now. But as she was driving down the road, Rebecca said, "I want to tell you something that happened to me, but I can't really tell you because I don't want to say a bad word." And so Nina, you know, they went back and forth, and Nina's like, "Well, you got to tell me what happened. I don't want to say a bad word." So Nina gave her a pen and a paper and asked her to write down what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that Rebecca wrote down the word sex. And from there, the conversation started, and Rebecca told her about how she had been molested and raped and sodomized. And that, of course, as you can imagine, that's where Nina really broke down on the stand, was trying to explain this. She said that that night, Rebecca really wanted to go to a Christmas parade, and so they didn't immediately go to the hospital, which was something that the defense attorney, I think, harped on for a little while. They did not immediately go to the hospital, but I think that was a Friday, and the following Monday, they went to the hospital, and that's when she was examined by a doctor and a nurse, and Nina was there in the room for all of that and was able to tell the jury some of the things that happened when she was being examined as well, because just like the investigator was limited in his testimony, the doctor was also. He couldn't, I don't believe he could say what Rebecca told him, so Nina kind of relayed the answers to the doctor's questions, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Perhaps that just shows exactly the challenge the prosecutors were up against. They really had to be creative in getting some of this evidence in.
Are you able to comment on the, I guess, some of the statements that are made that from family members that there may be additional victims of Bob Engel? Is that just rumor at this time?
If I'm trying to think back in my first conversations with the family, there was a lot of talk about that. And I really can't recall whether they were able to ever name names or whether they just assumed that there would be more victims, because often when you've got someone who abuses a child, there are more than one victim. I do remember in some of the early interviews with the first prosecutor on this case, he actually made a public plea for more more victims. Mm-hmm. He believed that there were more out there, and one time to our camera, looked into our camera and said, if you are a victim of Bob Engel, we want you to come forward. From what I understand, from the best of my knowledge, no one else has come forward. But there was that belief out there.
Now, Engel is supposed to be sentenced February 25th. Have you heard anything regarding an appeal?
There's no doubt in my mind that his attorney, Michael Harvin, will probably appeal this case based on their constitutional arguments alone. He has not said yet that he's going to, but I would not be surprised at all. I imagine that would come out in the next few days.
Absolutely. What about bond?
He is out on bond right now. I believe he's on he has a GPS ankle bracelet keeping track of him. I think I heard some conversations among the family about that. But I'm not sure what his bond is, but I do know he's out on bond, and we'll have a bond hearing coming up, I think, at the end of this week.
Yeah, I think you're right. One final comment, Jessica. Your thoughts on the family's reaction to finally some justice, I guess.
There's no doubt there was relief there. I mean, of course, lots of tears, not just from Rebecca's sister, but her biological father, who also testified during the trial, although his testimony was limited as well. There were lots of tears. I think bittersweet moment there. I mean, they get the justice that they have waited so long for. They still don't have Rebecca back.
No, that's for sure. You know, it's just a small piece. And, you know, Becca, as the family told me many times on the show, is able to speak even from beyond the grave, as strange as that sounds. Jessica Taloney, WKRG reporter, thank you.
Thank you.
Great job reporting on the story, by the way.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. And that's Jessica Taloney, and the case is one that I'll never forget. It's one that, again, I try to stay as neutral as I possibly can when I cover these stories, but, you know, talking to Aidan McAvoy and Rhonda Wheelis and everyone connected to this, I am so glad that they were finally able to get their day in court. We'll see what the appeals process brings. You know, there are many forms of justice. There's justice in court, and there's the ultimate justice that the man upstairs brings, and I'm not talking about the guy that lives above me. I'm talking about, you know who, and there'll be a special place for Bob Engel, I'm sure. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. After 15 years in the district attorney's office, several books, victims advocate, you name it, analyst on television, and now doing an excellent job reporting on her internet radio show along with police babe Stacey Dietrich. Justice Interrupted, by the way, go to justiceinterrupted.com or robinsacks.com, or I will hunt you down if you don't listen to their program every Sunday night, although they're taking Super Bowl night off. I don't understand that. Is Robin Sacks with our weekly Nothing But the Sacks segment. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening. Let me just tell you that taking the Super Bowl off was a Stacey Dietrich move.
I believe it.
So we can register all complaints with Stacey at justiceinterrupted.com.
Well, you know, you might miss out on three listeners that night that didn't watch the the Super Bowl. I've done that before, too. I've done shows on Super Bowl nights and then wondered, what's the problem? And then realized later that it's Super Bowl night. So, nevertheless, I am so proud of the work that you two are doing on that program. You are kicking butt. I've listened to the last few shows, and the interviews are excellent. The shows are getting better and better, and well done with that. Anyway, enough of that right now. Let's talk about the breaking news tonight that Conrad Murray will be turning himself in tomorrow. It's being reported on several of the celebrity websites like TMZ. Your thoughts?
You know, I got to tell you, TMZ has surprised us all in refreshing accuracy in their reporting. And I'm not here to knock TMZ at all, because I actually do think RVD Levin does an amazing job. He's a diligent guy. He's out working the phones, working his tips all day long, every day. However, I think they've got it wrong on this one. I think they have it wrong. I don't think that there will be a big turn-in tomorrow. I think that this is much ado about nothing. What I think has happened is that Conrad Murray is in Los Angeles. That is true. That has been confirmed. by various sources, including his own lawyer, that's Attorney Chernoff. But from what I'm hearing is, and what I think is happening, is that Matt Ternan was included a phone call to law enforcement that said, we are in town, and should you guys decide that now is the time to charge us, I'm here and available, so give us the courtesy of you know, letting us know first. As you know, that's very common practice in not just a celebrity case, but in cases where you have a private defense attorney and a cooperative defendant. They want to make it easy for everyone, and it's probably someone who's going to bail out. A surrender is not out of the world. So I think that they were just giving them the courtesy of letting, and when I say them, I think that Murray's attorneys were giving them the courtesy of letting them know that they were in town, and that somehow got translated through the game of telephone of he's now turning himself in. That's yeah. what I think.
And you heard it here first. And if Robin happens to be right, make sure and email all those news organizations that the source with the most information is former AD Robin Sack. You know, I think you're right. And I happened to hear you talk about this on your Justice Interrupted program last week, that this investigation, and again, I'm speculating right now because I have no idea, but I can speculate and I may be right, is much bigger than just Conrad Murray, or am I wrong?
Right. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, you know, as a cop, a detective, that everyone, and as a prosecutor, this is the kind of case that you want to put all the defendants together in one trial if there are multiple defendants. And we all know that the defense in this case, besides the fact that's the obvious, that Michael Jackson somehow is the one who dictated who's giving what drugs when, but besides doing that, there's no doubt in my mind that Conrad Murray will also say, well, this doctor gave this prescription and this doctor did that prescription, and because of all of the combination of such drugs, that, you know, that caused or participated in the causation of death, or at least to point fingers every which way. So how, as a prosecutor, are you going to handle all of those pointing fingers? Well, charge all the other doctors who also gave illegal prescriptions and should have been prescribing to Michael Jackson. And by doing that, then they all can point the fingers at each other during the trial. If those doctors are not all tried together, then it's very likely that a lot of those statements as to other doctors would be excluded from the trial part. So the prosecutors, not to mention the fact that anything surrounding Michael Jackson is going to be a big pain in the neck for logistical purposes, for media purposes and everything else, the best and cleanest way to do it is charge them all together, let them point the fingers every which way, and charge them as one. So I do agree with the report that it is likely that the Conrad Murray part of the investigation is done and complete, but I'm guessing that for some of the other doctors, there's a lot of documentation and ordering different, you know, batches of drugs and figuring out which things came from which doctor, ordered on which date, and the real big wild card out there, frankly, is Dr. Arne Klein.
Yep.
How much the question the prosecutors, I'm sure, want to know is how much was he the orchestrator? Was he the ringman in terms of getting and bringing doctors together? Was he the point person? And that's going to be the most, if there is going to be a doctor that's going to be charged, that's going to be a very difficult prosecution, it would be him. And that's what I think they're working on.
There's no doubt in my mind that you'll be called as a media analyst in this case once it does come down. And when you look at, I'm trying to look at a case that parallels this somewhat, although not in the same stature as far as celebrityism, if that's a word, is Anna Nicole. And it took some time before the doctors there and Howard K. Stern were brought to justice, so to speak. When this happens, Robin, whether it's tomorrow or the next day, and I agree with you, Harvey Levin at TMZ and his staff have done a great job, but I think they're jumping the gun a little bit on this one. When it does happen, though, the media is going to be all over this like a bird on a bug, and we're going to see nothing but. And I asked this of a guest earlier on tonight, and I'm going to ask you, all of a sudden now that story, and I'm not saying it isn't a big story, because of course it is, it's huge, is going to take precedent over many other stories and many other victims and many other families that are looking for that piece of media that you provide with Stacy on your program and we do here and other places, but Michael Jackson is going to inundate media like you'd never believe. Your thoughts on that, and is it fair?
Well, yes, I do think that this will be a case that already is catching a ton of buzz. Yes, I've already been called, and different media outlets are, you know, reserving me for tomorrow and so forth, just in case these breaking news comes and so forth. But, you know, and I agree. I think that it will take the way away from cases that get media, otherwise would get media attention. But I say that with a big sort of next to it, because part of the reason why I think that this news broke right about now is we're kind of, Los Angeles is in a little bit of a lull right now. We're in a post-Polanski lull. There is no great big celebrity crime story going on right now.
Yeah.
And it's shameful. But the fact of the matter is, what other stories have you heard for the last week when there wasn't Polanski or there wasn't Conrad Murray?
Yep.
We heard John Edwards. So I take a little bit of a different stance, is that I think that the traditional media will always go to the salacious.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not a criminal salacious matter, then it will be an extramarital affair salacious matter, or it will be a drunken stupor salacious matter, or a divorce salacious matter. And I think that the cases that so badly need attention never get the attention that they deserve. There are very few traditional outlets, if any, and only people like yourself and the bloggers out there and people like me and Stacy, who and there are other people who do it, but not in the traditional sense of putting the focus on the cases that so badly need the attention.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs is here, and check out our webpage at robinsachs.com. Robin and I do a weekly segment here on the program talking about crime, high-profile cases, and anything that happens to come to mind. A case that you and I have covered, we talked about a little bit last week, and I want to get more of your thoughts on it now, is the McAvoy case. We have a conviction. Bob Engel will be sentenced February 25th, I'm told. I interviewed one of the TV reporters tonight that has covered the story since day one, and I'm wondering your thoughts. Obviously, this case is going to be appealed with the Crawford versus Washington take on it, but I'm curious on Robin Sachs's take.
Well, Robin Sachs is thrilled that there's been a conviction in this case. I was super impressed with the family and with all the people who have known that the case has actually gone to trial, and really respected gag orders that were in place and did their best not to sensationalize it or do anything, including the reporter that you had on, and I forget her name, been covering it from day one, and I apologize about that. But when it comes to the news for me and you that this happened, that we don't know it, and this is the case we're following, you know, the people who were a part of this process had all the integrity in terms of making sure that this case would not be appealed. But having said that, in this situation where you have testimony that was admitted when, you know, hearsay testimony that was admitted as evidence and potentially in violation of Crawford v. Washington, at least the argument was made, there is always it's going to be an appeal. But having said that, I think that the court was reluctant in this case to admit the evidence. They were reluctant to take this case seriously from the beginning. And despite the fact that Beck McAvoy wasn't there, the jury came back and convicted Bob Engel on all of the charges. So I think that, you know, it's a risk that it has to be taken, and it's a case that is going to go up on appeal. I do agree that there were some issues with it, and I would be kind of holding my breath if I was the prosecutor in the case, because this is kind of one of those situations where the court could come up with some sort of legal fiction or legal way to get the result they want. As you know, the same thing works in law enforcement. There's two ways to do an investigation. There's an investigation where you can go out and do it and have an idea of what you want the result to be, and then you go look for everything to make that result happen. Or you can kind of say, I'm going to just look at this open-mindedly and see where the result takes us. I'm hoping the judge doesn't look at this case with a I want to make this case go away lens. and find any way to do it, because if they want to find a way to do it, I think that they can. But I hope that what they do is they look at all the evidence and look at the law and look that this case falls squarely within the exceptions.
Absolutely. What do you think of the jury? And I just found this out tonight because the notes I had said the jury came back in 9 hours, but the TV reporter says it was 90 minutes.
Yeah, I've heard conflicting on that too. That even still, 9 hours or 90 minutes, frankly, or 9 hours was fast on a case like this. I mean, but when I read some reports that they were that what some jurors said was the real pushing moment for them, or the pushover, was when Becca identified her perpetrator by the badge, or drew the badge during her forensic interview or whatever, and drew that badge as that being the person who had done these awful sex acts against her. And it seemed to me that there's kind of two ways cases can go. They can either be, convictions really quickly in this case, and usually convictions or cases that are resolved in a quick amount of time tend to be convictions as opposed to not convictions. Not convictions take a lot longer. So to me, that says they had no doubt in their mind this wasn't a struggle. This was a dead-bang case, and more of the reason why he should be sentenced for a really long time.
The show is Justice Interrupted. You can hear Robin and Stacey Dietrich on Sundays. Go to justiceinterrupted.com. The show's on Block Talk Radio. And, of course, Robin's website is robinsacks.com. I think you'll see her a lot in the next few days or the next few weeks on a lot of the cable news shows talking about Mr. Jackson. Thanks, Robin. See you next week.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Robin Sacks. And, it will be interesting to see who's right, Harvey Levin or Robin Sacks. My money's on Robin. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with our sister blogger, Blink, from Blink on Crime, talking more about the Morgan Dana Harrington case. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. I'm very proud to be associated, of course, with Scared Monkeys and all the fine folks there and the radio program that we do. And I like to call her our sister blogger, Blink, from Blink on Crime. And I thought I would bring Blink on tonight to talk about Morgan Dana Harrington because you can't find many blogs on the Internet. And, of course, we all know about blogs and the good reporting that they do over at Blink that has covered this case better than Blink on Crime. That's for sure. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Dana. First, I'd like to thank you for giving me the Leno spot and not the Conan O'Brien spot. I'm privileged.
Yeah, right. Isn't that something? You know, listen, this case, I'm so glad she was found. Obviously, it's so sad that she was deceased. Not sure if you got to hear the program, but I had Clint Van Sant on earlier talking about Morgan Dana Harrington, and of course we've given out the information page about where tips can be sent in. I'm curious your take on the recovery of Morgan Dana Harrington.
Well, first of all, I would like to say thank you. I think you had my very esteemed colleague Robin on last week when we broke this story, actually. We had some contacts on scene when Dear Morgan was recovered. And so I want to thank you for mentioning that, because we certainly worked very hard. But my take on it is, first and foremost, thank God that she was recovered, because as we've talked about in the past, any family will tell you, it's excruciating when someone you love is missing, and the not knowing is by far worse than what's to come. So that's a very thankful proposition. But I will say, in a general way, I don't believe that the person or persons responsible for placing Morgan there, or to her ultimate end being there, thought that she would be found. I do think Mother Nature has played somewhat of a role in helping us recover her.
You know, as strange as it sounds, and we've seen this in many cases, it's almost like there's a, you're right, call it Mother Nature, call it a better source to help us find the person, because without finding that person, it's very difficult to bring a case. Now, witness testimony is great, Blink. Clint and I talked about this earlier, but it's going to be, in my opinion, ultimately a DNA, some sort of forensic evidence that hopefully will solve this matter. Your thoughts on that?
I agree with Clint, which I mostly do. I find him to be one of the the best, you know, pundits there is in terms of, you know, research in a case. You know, I've not heard you interview Mr. Van Zandt where he wasn't completely versed and could answer any question, which I so respect. But what I agree with you that it is the recovery of her remains and the wealth of information, and that's a quote, actually, by Morgan's father, Dr. Dan Harrington, that was recovered at the scene, both forensically and anthropologically, I believe, will point a finger. But more than that, and Clint alluded to that, is the location itself.
Right.
We feel very strongly that the location is of someone that's indigenous to that location. It was specifically chosen for a variety of reasons. But as I reported on earlier in the week, we had also found that there were a number of private hunting memberships that had hunting cameras on that land at the time that this happened. It was full-blown archery season for deer, which according to the landowner, Mr. Bass, there's not a large amount of hunters, but there was some incidents of poaching and things along those lines. But we feel strongly that there's going to be some evidence, some ancillary evidence that will add to what was found when Morgan was recovered. And as the blogosphere goes and as the Help Find Morgan Facebook, which was launched by people that are you know, very empathetic and caring to the Harringtons and, of course, Morgan, will show, we think that there's a possibility that there may have been a connection to Morgan prior to her going missing. We think that's a possibility. I wouldn't go as far as to say it's a probability, but I will, you know, there is always the chance that this was a completely random act and a crime of opportunity.
Yeah.
And that there's some merit to that. I personally do not think so. I don't think that this young lady is either the victim of, in one evening, the cataclysmic, worst possible chain of events that could happen to one individual to lead her to where she was ultimately recovered, or a series of events that have to do with a known offender, or a series of events of a known offender and an unknown, accidental or unplanned scenario.
Yeah, and that is so true. That is so true. And I want to end up, Blink, I won't keep you too long, and I appreciate you coming on. You know, we see the families, and we see the hurt and the sorrow, and we also see their determination to try and find answers. You know, we've talked Kessie and Holloway, and I could bring on, you know, probably a dozen names that come to mind right now. But the Harrington family obviously are wanting answers, wanting justice, for lack of a better term. Sites like yours and Scared Monkeys bring the questions to the public. But sadly, with Michael Jackson and Conrad Murray and all this nonsense that's going to hit the media here in the next few days,
right,
I think we're not going to hear much about Morgan Dana Harrington in the cable news media or mainstream media. That's why the internet is so important. Your thoughts on the coverage of the case so far?
Well, I think I would agree with both Robin and Clint, and I would say that from a personal perspective, my readership has doubled in terms of the interest in Morgan's case. So for me, I can tell you that, and not just that from a readership perspective, but from a contributor's perspective of people that are genuinely posting and are interested in developments in the case, what upsets me is that there are so many families, and not just people that are interested in what happened to Morgan and answers for a successful prosecution, but also of other cases that are out there in the news. There's been an arrest today in Baby Gabriel's case.
Yep, right.
There are other missing folks that, in my opinion, need coverage. And personally, as a personal preference, I have not covered the Michael Jackson case on my site once.
Right.
Nor will I.
And good for you, because there's, I'm not saying that it isn't high profile, but there's certainly more important cases. And, you know, Blank, you could do a story on a different case every day. I could do the show every day. And if the powers to be wanted us to, we would. We do what we can to try and help, but we're all volunteers, and we put our own sweat, blood, and tears into this. And it's just a shame that the big boys don't follow along. I'll give you the last word.
I would just, first of all, I would just like to say, in response to genuine folks out there that are interested in true crime and missing persons cases, thank you for following along, because that is how they get progressed.
Yep.
So that's important. And I would certainly like to extend my condolences as Morgan is being laid to rest this Friday with her family and friends, and hopefully it's going to be televised, etc. I would like to give my condolences to her family, to Jill Harrington, to Dr. Dan Harrington, and to her brother Alex Harrington, in their fight to secure justice for what happened to Morgan, and also to bring to light a serious epidemic, Dana. Underage drinking is, I've never seen on Facebook what I have seen while we're investigating this case. And I will tell you, I have two 20-year-old nieces that are sophomores in college. And the first thing I did when I saw this case was to check if they were on Facebook and to call them and to say, we need to have a conversation about personal security.
Yep.
And we need to make a commitment to each other that if you're ever in a situation where you're left alone, or you find yourself away from your core group, that you need to make these calls. Here's your list. Here's your top three, that you have a commitment that we will drop anything and everything to secure your safety. And I'm asking parents, I'm asking friends, do not leave your friend or colleague on their own in a public setting where security could be a factor.
You know, so true, and we can all be victims of crime, have loved ones who are victims of crime. My family has, maybe yours has, or a lot of you out there in the listenership, I'm sure have. We may be able to get our victims home, our family members home, but families like the Harringtons and others who lose their loved ones pay the ultimate sacrifice, and we need to do what we can to try and control it and stop it if necessary. Blink, thank you.
Thank you, Dana. So true. Good. Have a good evening.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that's Blink from blinkoncrime.com, sister blog to Scared Monkeys, blinkoncrime.com, or just click the link in the show notes and you'll find lots of good information on the Harrington case there. That's it. That's tonight's show. I want to thank all my guests, and thank you for listening, and we'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.